A part of the world like ours where the sun shines a lot is a place to think about the possibilities of using the sun for more of our energy needs. And our guest not only thinks about that, he practices what he preaches. Robert Arthur Staton is the author of a book pointing a way toward a future in which the sun provides, directly or indirectly, all of our energy needs. His book is Power Shift, From Fossil Energy to Dynamic Solar Power. Robert Arthur Staton is a writer living in Santa Cruz County. He holds a master's degree in physics and taught college courses in physics, energy, and solar energy at UC Santa Cruz and Cabrillo College in Aptos. Robert, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Well, thanks for having me, Jeff.
I noticed you wrote a white paper, too, Prospects for the Use of Solar Energy in California. How was that used?
Well, that was quite a long time ago. I was an intern at the Assembly Office of Research in Sacramento as a science writing intern, and they were looking for topics that would sort of stimulate what legislators might do for forward-looking projects, and so I suggested solar energy, and then they basically turned me loose and let me do the research and write a paper on the prospects for the use of solar energy in California. And they actually went on to, we reviewed it with the principal legislator who was sponsoring that kind of stuff, and they went on to put together the California Solar Tax Credit. And that bill, I believe, was a direct result of my paper, but I can't know for sure. But it appeared about 6 months after my paper was released, so I think I contributed to that.
Did you catch solar power fever a very long time ago?
I did, actually. In the late 70s, I was a graduate student in physics at the University of California in Santa Cruz and took a course on alternative sources of energy and realized that someone with a physics background could contribute to this, and it felt like just the right thing to get into because I wanted to do something that was more engaging in society. And so energy and solar energy looked like a really great thing to pursue.
Power Shift looks like a textbook. Is it meant to be?
Well, no, it isn't meant to be a textbook. I wrote it in language that anyone could understand. It could be used as a textbook in an environmental studies course because I tried to make it as comprehensive and complete as possible. I really wanted to show all the information that was out there on solar energy and all the advantages of it and how we could pursue it and address all the potential negatives as well. So, in all, I think it's fairly balanced. It would serve as a textbook in a course, but it's really meant for the general public to bring everyone up to speed on what's going on in the world of energy these days.
And one of the things you do right off the bat is make a distinction between energy and power. How do they differ?
Well, energy, I refer to energy as these stockpiles of fossil fuels that we get out of the ground. Energy stores, not a store where you buy energy, but a store of energy, a stockpile of energy. And we extract those and basically burn them to produce the energy that we need. The energy is just sitting there in the ground in a static form, whereas solar energy comes to us not in a static form but in a dynamic flow from the sun, a continuous flow of energy from the sun. And rather than burn it, we just have to figure out how to harness it. Basically, the energy is already flowing from the sun. It's all around us, and all we need to do is tap into it to make it use. Make it more useful to us.
So we're not setting it on fire as we do with the fossil fuels.
Exactly. With fossil fuels, we pretty much have to burn them in order to get the energy out of them. And in the burning process, that's when, of course, the carbon is combined with oxygen, which makes carbon dioxide, which is the principal problem with fossil fuels these days, which is the buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that's producing climate change.
Yeah, I failed to note that at the time you got interested in solar energy, this was well before we started talking about solar energy as a good place to go because of our desire to stop burning as much in the way of fossil fuels. So, I mean, you were ahead of the curve on that one. And it seems like it's become a lot more urgent, obviously, since we began to talk about climate change.
Actually, yeah, that's for sure. Finally, I think solar is really getting some excellent traction because it's emerging as such a good alternative to the fossil fuels. And it works. And it works today, so we can start applying it now.
Frame the issue as you see it, then. Why is there so much foot-dragging about efforts to slow or stop our carbon releases, our use of fossil fuels?
Well, at the international level, they look at it only in terms of restricting carbon emissions. That's their point of view. And when you look at it from that point of view and you realize that our economy, the world economy, runs on fossil fuels, when they associate those two things, they immediately assume when you restrict carbon emissions, you're going to be restricting economic activity. And most countries and most politicians have no interest in restricting economic activity, or at least being blamed for it. And so they talk a good line. They'll say, yes, we're all for controlling carbon emissions and reducing climate change. But when it actually comes down to making decisions and putting those restrictions in place, they don't want to do it. They hesitate and basically defer it for the future. And that seems to carry less political risk for them. Whereas with solar energy, we're not actually going to be restricting carbon emissions. We're going to be replacing them. And that's the approach I think they should be taking. These international negotiations should be focusing more on not restricting, but abandoning carbon emissions in favor of replacing them with solar energy.
But that's an interesting point, that they're afraid to get into the position of saying, don't do this without providing an alternative. And you're saying, here is the alternative. This is a do this kind of situation.
Well, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, was because I felt like they weren't talking about the whole picture. They were talking about just restricting carbon. And I understand their reticence to do that, but there is a good alternative, and it's in place now. And I've been using solar energy for 18 years now in our house, and I can tell you, it really does work.
Are you using only solar energy at the house? I didn't quite understand whether you're completely commercial power free.
Not completely. We have an off-grid solar house, so I'd say 90% of our electricity comes from the sun. We have a generator and a backup for the wintertime when we don't have enough sun. And eventually I'd like to get that converted over. We also have a plug-in Prius car, which is a combination of electric car and gas car, so we can charge it up from our solar panels and drive for about 12 or 13 miles on pure solar power. And that reduces our gasoline consumption considerably, but it doesn't eliminate it. So we're partway there and hoping to get further.
All right, much more to talk about with Robert Arthur Staton. His book is Power Shift, From Fossil Energy to Dynamic Solar Power. It makes a case that we actually can make the transition to solar power in pretty short order. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Robert and your phone calls and emails in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Robert Arthur Staton, a writer living in Santa Cruz, California, master's degree in physics and taught college courses in physics, energy, and solar energy. He has written a book called Power Shift, From Fossil Energy to Dynamic Solar Power, making a case and, in fact, laying out a blueprint for how we get to largely dependent upon the sun for all of our energy sources, directly or indirectly, in just a few years. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. We have a momentary internet outage on our end, it appears, but keep trying. And the phone certainly works. And so, Robert, you point out we are the only energy-using animal, which becomes clear when we stop to think about it. We don't see chimpanzees lighting fires or anything like that. And you provide a fun equivalent as well. What's the equivalent in gasoline of our own body expenditures of energy in a day?
Well, if you're looking at the energy that's contained in our food and convert that to gasoline energy, it's about a cup of energy. One cup of energy from gasoline is equivalent to all the food that you eat.
As you walk us through human history, and everything from wood fires to water power to the use of sails and windmills and stuff like that, I'm struck by the ingenuity, which also raises the question, did fossil fuels make us lazy once we could set things on fire and just let them make our energy for us? Did we stop thinking about ingenious ways to harness natural forms of energy?
I don't think so, but actually, if you look at the history of solar energy, it continues through the whole fossil fuel era. There were a lot of people who were pursuing explorations in the use of solar energy for pumping water. They made steam engines by focusing sunlight. But they never really caught on because fossil fuels became so cheap and so easy to use. But the research did continue.
All right, explanation time here. You describe gunpowder as wood and ultimately solar energy?
Well, I tend to think in terms of the bigger picture of energy and look at the energy flows and where things come from. And wood, of course, is turned into charcoal to make one component of gunpowder. The source of energy in wood is photosynthesis that grew the tree, and the source of energy for photosynthesis is the sun. So if you trace the energy back, you find that the source of energy for gunpowder is the sun.
Ah, okay. So it's interesting, too, to note that there were government regulations on energy, for example, banning coal fires in London in the 13th century. How did that go over?
Well, not very well at all. It was a coal had become the primary source of heating for people in London because the city had grown so big that it had stripped the forests around it, and there was little wood available for burning. So when they found that coal could be imported, they started using that for heating all their homes. But the problem, of course, is that coal doesn't burn completely clean, and it builds up in the atmosphere. And at one point, the king of England, who was living in London, got so fed up with it that he just banned the burning of coal. And, of course, people having no alternative basically did it anyway because they really couldn't stop heating their homes.
It's a really interesting viewpoint, though, to talk about the fact that that people couldn't burn wood anymore because there were very few trees left around. We like to think of ourselves as smarter as the centuries go by, but do you think we've actually reached the point where we're going to stop getting rid of things or, you know, dealing with using things up to the point of depletion?
Well, it is something that we're not very good at in terms of planning ahead. With the issue with burning of trees, people didn't think in terms of depleting the forest. They just needed to get the energy that they needed. And this year they had to travel a little bit further, and this year, next year, a little bit further, and didn't realize that they were actually depleting it. With fossil fuels, it's pretty clear that they are a limited resource. They're not being produced at any rate that's useful to us. So they are on a path to depletion, and we are beginning to recognize that fact, but actually doing something about it means putting something in place to replace it. So, and that's what the whole idea of solar is.
It's interesting, though, to think about the fact that, we get into situations like just hearing this morning in the news that that Russia has claimed a large portion of the Arctic seabed as its own, and this is an area that's apparently rich with oil and gas reserves on the planet Earth. I mean, some of the best remaining ones on the planet Earth. So here, you know, we're talking on one hand about let's go ahead with solar energy, and on the other hand, well, hey, look, there's all this great new stuff we could burn.
Well, there are great economic forces at work that will try to continue the fossil fuel industry. There's an enormous amount of money involved in it. The top 10 corporations in the world, has traditionally been 8 or 9 of them have been oil companies. So it's a gigantic industry, and they need to continue it from their point of view. However, the rest of society is realizing that we can't continue it on indefinitely if we're going to get climate change and ocean acidification under control. So there's basically this conflict developing, and it's not going to be an easy fight. There will be a lot of resistance, and the fossil fuel companies will continue to pursue things like Arctic drilling, which, boy, I dread seeing what comes out of that because the potential for spills up there and controlling it sounds just like a nightmare. But I think if we look in terms of replacing all of that, we'll be much better off.
Robert Arthur Staton is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Power Shift: From Fossil Energy to Dynamic Solar Power. The principle of the conservation of energy, that it can't be destroyed, but so we spend it, though. I mean, so what? Where does it go?
Well, that's also kind of confusing because people think in terms of they fill up their gas tank with gas and they burn it and the gas is gone. But if you look at the principle of conservation of energy in physics, it means that what's actually happening in a car is that energy is transforming from one form to another in order to do something useful for it. So when we burn it in a car, it transforms from chemical energy into heat, and that heat then drives the piston, which pushes the car forward. But the heat is still there. And, of course, if you put your hand near the exhaust of the car, you'll notice there's a tremendous amount of heat pouring out the exhaust. So the energy is still around. It's just in a form that we can't use very effectively because it's heat that's flowing into the atmosphere and dissipating, and we lose track of it, essentially. But we convert energy from a form that we want into a form that we can no longer use, and that's how we get the use out of it.
There's a whole chapter here on the dependency on fossil fuels, and it's interesting when you, and I got to stop using that word, sorry, but the amount of energy expended to make our food is rather remarkable.
Yeah, it is. Over time, through the mechanization of farming, by applying tractors and harvesters and all of that, running on fossil fuels, plus the energy that goes into making fertilizer. Most people don't realize that most nitrogen fertilizer comes from natural gas. And then, of course, the processing of food, once it's harvested, goes through food processing systems that cook it and package it and deliver it. When they do the studies to actually look at all the energy that goes into handling all that food, they find that the amount of energy used to make it available is 8 or 10 times the amount of energy that's in the food itself. Now, that's an investment that we make because we need the food, And of course, we can't eat the fossil fuels, but we do have to recognize that fact that our food system is highly dependent on a supply of energy, and there's no way we could just cut back on energy without doing something to make sure we have some energy available to produce our food supply.
One of many reasons people talk in terms of eating locally, because at least you cut down on transportation costs and the burning of fossil fuels to get the food to you.
Exactly. And of course, organic farming uses a lot less energy too.
You list 10 reasons why fossil fuels are not good for us anymore. Number 5 is oil is not cheap anymore, but at the moment, by comparison, I mean, at least by comparison to recent years, it's fairly cheap, isn't it?
Well, yeah. If you look at the price of oil over history, of course, it fluctuates greatly, and that's why it's hard to pin down what the price of oil is. However, if you compare the price of oil since the turn of the century, that is, once we passed the year 2000, it has not gone back down to its previous levels prior to that. So in this particular century, since then, we've gone up substantially, and it's not going to go back down.
Do you favor any taxes? I know that there are the likes of Tom Friedman who've talked about we should just stabilize gasoline, for example, at $4 a gallon and let the difference between the actual cost of gasoline be taken up by the tax if it drops below $4 a gallon, so that the tax would rise as the actual gas price falls. I mean, do you favor things like that to make sure that we keep people spurred on looking for alternatives?
Well, I would like people to think in terms of people object to the word tax, of course, because they feel like government taxes them enough, and any tax that they impose will just go into the kitty to be used for projects that they don't want to see happening. But in actual fact, what's being proposed mostly is a carbon tax, which would be a very specific tax applied to carbon-based fuels like coal, oil, and natural gas. And then that carbon tax revenue should be devoted to doing the transition to get us off of fossil fuels. So it would support incentives or tax breaks for solar and wind. And by applying it from one directly to the other, people can see the connection and realize that, yes, okay, I'm paying this tax, but it's going for a good purpose. At least I hope they think that way. Mm-hmm. And the other thing they could do is to phase it in gradually so that it doesn't hurt immediately, but people can plan ahead and think in terms of, well, it doesn't hurt now, but it's going to in a few years. So I think I'll start planning for my solar system in a couple of years and get that in place so that I can avoid the increasing rate of the taxation.
Robert Arthur Staton is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Power Shift, From Fossil Energy to Dynamic Solar Power. He lays out a blueprint for how we move toward a much greater dependence on the sun as our primary energy source. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org, by email. We may have a few minutes left before we pick up your emails because we seem to be having an internet outage here at the station, but we'll get that fixed promptly, I'm confident. So by phone, again, 800-838-3760. Let's go to Jacob in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, I wanted to point out that petroleum and coal, even natural gas, are a form of solar energy. It's from ancient plants, you know, that were used photosynthesis and then combined and compressed and over time became the fuels that we use today. Earth before was just a cold rock orbiting the sun. The sun provided all the energy. It provided the current, for instance, biofuels, trees, crops for us to eat. It even provided nuclear energy in terms of it heated up the planet and the gravity compressed it and made into these radioactive isotopes. And today we also use winds are driven by solar heating and solar convections. So actually, what I'm pointing out is the sun is primacy when it comes to energy for everything on this planet. You can't point to any form of energy that was not once derived from sunlight.
Which I think our guest completely agrees with. Thanks for that, Jacob. Is that pretty much where you're coming from, Robert?
Well, yeah, and certainly fossil fuels were created by photosynthesis millions of years ago and laid down and preserved as a form of ancient solar energy, as he points out. But I do like to distinguish between that ancient energy and the solar energy that we're producing now, primarily because of the effects of the carbon dioxide that's released when you burn the fossil fuels. But yeah, solar energy is our... If we wanted to look at any particular thing that was absolutely necessary for the survival of the planet, it would be the sun. and it provides not just heat, but all the light and fossil fuels and everything that we need. So, yes, I would agree with what he said.
You really do pack the book with a bunch of facts, and one of the more astounding ones is the idea that of how much more carbon would be emitted if everyone on the planet consumed like Americans. Something like four times the carbon?
Yeah, we would quadruple the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Right now, we've already increased it over 40% from what it was prior to the Industrial Revolution. Now, 40% is a really big increase in one component of the atmosphere, and we're the one that are doing that and altering the atmosphere, right, burning all these fossil fuels. So if we were go to burn all of them, then we would basically saturate the atmosphere with carbon dioxide to four times the level that it's at now, and it would have catastrophic effects.
So ending fossil fuel use, you do draw some distinctions between the industry and individuals. Do you think individuals hold any particular love for fossil fuels or the companies that put them out?
Well, I don't know if they would particularly say they love them, but they do like getting the energy. And the energy is, of course, very convenient. So doing nothing basically means that you stay on fossil fuels. You pay your bill, your utility bill, and you buy your gas, and you continue on as before. And solar energy is something that if you decide that you want to get off fossil fuels, photovoltaics is probably the way most people go. They can install solar panels on their roof or pursue it in other ways to get replacement for their solar for their fossil fuels by employing solar.
Robert Arthur Staten's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Power Shift from Fossil Energy to Dynamic Solar Power. Here's a call from Kathy and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, yes, I'm a member of American Solar Energy Society and Solar Oregon, and I was co-founder of Sunergy in Ashland called the Southern Oregon New Energy Institute in 1977, and later I directed the Oregon Energy Roundup at the State Fair from 1982 to 84, and I also initiated the founding of Energy Park at Oregon Country Fair, which founded in 81. So I have a long history, but one thing I did is I initiated the revised version of the residential solar energy tax credit called the RETC in the Oregon legislature after I found out that 85% of the solar business in Oregon and the country had gone bankrupt after the sunset of the state and the federal tax credits. And this has not been written anywhere in journalism. I mean, I've been busy selling real estate for the last 29 years trying to make a living. But if I had not taken a class at the University of Oregon Public Planning Department, I can almost guarantee you there would barely be any solar energy industry in Oregon today without the revising and rewriting of the residential energy tax credit. And that could still be in jeopardy in the next couple years, so I want to alert people they have to start thinking about that. And meanwhile, you know, Eugene Water and Electric Board has really been dropping the ball, in the opinion, up here. We're the largest publicly owned utility in Oregon, and they've let go of all of their solar wizards, as I call them. They used to be called the solar bozos, but I call them the wizards. And so the people who are kind of left on the staff have very little knowledge of solar energy and what it can do. And it's just a great regret on my part that we as a society do not take control of our utilities better.
All right. Thanks for that, Kathy. Appreciate it. So let's start talking about some of the mechanisms to move us towards solar, Robert. I mean, there's a lot of energy beaming down, and there are some physical obstacles to harnessing its use in the first place, correct?
Well, yes. As I said, it's a dynamic flow of energy from the sun that's going on continuously. And what we need to do is primarily the tools that we have today are wind turbines, which harness the energy produced from the sun that's converted into wind power. And photovoltaics, which are very simple panels that you just put up on your roof and generate electricity directly. The nice thing about photovoltaics is that pretty much anyone can do it. But we also need to put in place some energy storage. Because it's a dynamic flow of energy, it may be flowing when we don't need it, or it may not be flowing when we do need it, such as during cloudy weather or at night. So the nice thing about fossil fuels is that they come with built-in energy storage. They are really good at storing energy. They've been storing it for millions of years, whereas solar energy is not in a form of energy that's stored, so we have to convert some of it. And typically that's done, or has been done in the past, with batteries. So, for example, in my house, we have a set of batteries that we use to store the excess electricity during the day for use at night. And That system works extremely well. Our electricity is considerably more reliable than the local utility grid, we found. Our system is up and running when the local houses, everybody else is down because of utility problems. But if we combine the solar energy with energy storage, then we can have a 100% supply of energy that's available to us whenever we need it.
Storage is one of the big ones. We'll get to that in just a few moments. Power Shift from Fossil Energy to Dynamic Solar Power is the book by Robert Arthur Staton. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join our conversation about solar power and how to move into a position where we are getting fossil fuels well behind us and taking better care of the planet in the process. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Arthur Staton, Power Shift, and you in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Reinley. Thanks for listening to us today on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Our guest today is the writer Robert Arthur Staton from Santa Cruz County. He's written a book called Power Shift, from Fossil Energy to Dynamic Solar Power, that lays out a blueprint for the way ahead. Leave fossil fuels behind us and get to a greater dependence on an inexhaustible, apparently, supply of energy, and that is the sun. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments, observations about solar power, maybe some uses in your own life. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. Jeannie in Medford, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, my favorite subject in the whole world. Years ago, I worked for a scientist, well, actually a neurodynamicist, but this was his passion about the second law of thermodynamics and entropy, and what a horrible concept for people that don't know what it means to understand. So as crazy old scientists do, he invented a word called eportney, the opposite of entropy, so it sounded more positive, you know, with... Like Jeff said, you know, it destroyed and never energy. And where does that heat go? That was a great example with the car and the radiator, the muffler. And I'd like to know more about if the solar, if that would in any way, would it violate the second law? And I've met young students now, engineers coming up, that say, oh, yes, you can violate the second law of thermodynamics. And I'm just wondering how this all plays into the solar.
All right. Thanks for that.
Well, just to clarify for people, the second law of thermodynamics, which is not something everyone is familiar with, pretty much means that as you use energy, the quality of energy degrades over time. And that's the nature of using the energy. So when we burn our fossil fuels, we convert it from a concentrated chemical energy into a heat form of energy that then is dissipated into the environment. And that process of degradation is the entropy that she's referring to. The question is whether or not we could violate the second law of thermodynamics with solar. No, not at all. And it's not something that really even is necessary to do, because we can make use of the flow of the energy from the sun through the same process. It comes to us in the form of a high-quality form of energy, light. Light is pure energy. It's so great that it's not associated with any material, because when we use it, we don't have any material chemical leftovers like we do with burning fossil fuels. So when we use solar energy in a photovoltaic panel, the energy flows through the panel and we make use of some of it. But in the end, it does degrade into heat, and it follows the same process. It's just that we're tapping into it differently than we do with fossil fuels.
Given that you've been in this for getting close to 40 years now, it sounds like, it seems like that given all the other changes in technology over the years, I mean, we've come leaps and bounds since the late 70s, have there been as many big gains in solar and the promise for its use, its greater use by us?
Well, in terms of giant breakthroughs, no. It's mostly been a process of refinement and reducing the cost. Originally, the photovoltaics were developed for NASA for use on satellites, and they didn't really care how much they cost as long as they were extremely reliable. But if we're going to use them on Earth, then they needed to bring the cost down. And I remember in the 1970s, they were talking about, well, if we can get the price down to 50 cents per watt of panel, then it will take off by itself. And today we're at about 70 cents per watt, and in some places as low as 50 cents per watt. So basically the biggest thing that's happened is that the manufacturing has ramped up sufficiently and the process has been improved so that they can produce these panels at a much lower price so that they can be more cost effective against fossil fuels.
Do you read the price of oil every day and just hope it goes a little higher?
Actually, I pay as little attention to that as possible. I look more at what's going on with photovoltaics in the world.
There's a bunch of other stuff you indicate in here that maybe some of us haven't heard about, like a solar trough collector. What's that?
Well, in some cases, people need heat still. So if you want to produce high-temperature heat, you can create basically a long trough of reflective material, and at the focus of that trough, you put a pipe with a dark coating on it and circulate a liquid through it. And the reflectors in the trough concentrate the sunlight onto that pipe and produce pretty high temperatures, which you can then use to run a boiler, produce steam, or whatever you want to do with it, or produce process heat for a food processing plant, for example. And as that sun moves across the sky, those trough collectors have to move with the sun in order to keep the sunlight focused on that pipe.
And other variations on a theme, you show a solar power plant in Spain. How does that work?
Oh, in the thermal power plants that they're developing in certain countries, they put traditional boiler at the top of a tower, and then they surround that tower with a field of mirrors. And each mirror is mounted so that it can track the sun and reflect the sunlight onto the tower. And by having thousands of these mirrors, they produce the equivalent of thousands of suns of temperatures at the boiler. And they just boil it, make steam, and run a turbine. The other thing they do with that particular kind of arrangement, though, is they can store some of the heat during the day. And they store it in this material that retains the heat. And so after the sun goes down, they can continue to produce power.
Sounds like a magnifying glass, the way we used to, you know, set leaves and ants on fire.
Well, a little bit, but it's using mirrors instead of refraction, yeah.
Okay. You point out to a continued need for liquid fuels. You say we'll still need these. For what purposes?
Well, if you look at how we use energy today, one of the biggest uses of energy is transportation. And in transportation, you fill up your tank with a liquid fuel, and it's a portable form of energy. And in order to continue that kind of a system, we would still need some sort of a liquid fuel. And so that's where people think, well, we need to continue to have fossil fuels, so use the oil for that. But in actual fact, you can produce liquid fuels from sunlight. If you use the sun to generate electricity, the electricity can be passed through water to split the water into hydrogen and oxygen. And the hydrogen, containing most of the energy, can then be reacted further with other elements to produce any number of hydrocarbons. They can actually produce gasoline and diesel and any number, even jet fuel, from solar energy by doing that process. Right now, it's mostly a matter of that it's expensive to do so relative to the cheap fossil fuels that are still coming out of the ground, but it is possible to do that today. Now, whether or not we will have that next year or in 10 years, it's hard to say, but that work is undergoing development now, and it should produce some results pretty soon.
Okay, that answers the first question, which is expense. The other one is what it requires in the way of water, one of the necessary components, obviously, of this whole electrolysis process.
Well, it's not a lot of water that gets split in terms of volume. It's relative. There's probably more water used in keeping the rest of the system going than in actual splitting, but it would be a contributor, and we wouldn't have to consider that as part of the process, yeah.
And, Robert, what do you make of attempts to make various starchy plants into liquid fuels, even algae, for example?
Well, the idea of biofuels is one that's being pursued on many, many different avenues. The one that's the biggest right now, of course, is corn alcohol, and that's not a very good system because, as I mentioned, the amount of energy that goes into making the corn through the agricultural processes that we have today is either close to or equal to the amount of energy that we get out of the corn alcohol when we burn it. So in terms of net energy, it's not a very good arrangement. So people are looking at other possibilities of growing crops, which they could then convert through some algae process or enzyme process to fuels. And some people have managed to produce something like diesel fuel through an algae process. And through genetic engineering of algae, they can have the algae excrete energy in the form of this fuel. So, but again, it's in the early stages of development. No one yet has something that's practically producing it. But I could see something like that coming about.
But if you're burning plant material, does that not also release some greenhouse gases?
Well, if you produce your fuel from the sun, you can extract the carbon from the atmosphere to produce it. And if you extract the carbon from the atmosphere when you make it and then release it back to the atmosphere when you burn it, there's no net carbon released into the atmosphere. So we wouldn't be increasing the amount like we do when we burn fossil fuels, which is releasing carbon that was captured millions of years ago when we had much higher concentration of carbon in the atmosphere.
Right. So to make fuels from the sun, you get you do sequester carbon, but then you burn it back out. And,
exactly. It's a round-trip process, and it doesn't increase the net amount of carbon in the atmosphere.
Let's take a call. We have Grumpy John and Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Arthur Staton, the author of Power Shift.
Thanks. A couple of quick observations while I was on hold. The corn ethanol actually degrades your mileage, so you're actually not even breaking even. You're actually losing it. And then a comment about the mirror array in Spain. Nice way to heat water, but it's very bad for birds flying around. And another real quick comment. People say, oh, we should go nuclear. They don't realize that the amount of cement in a nuclear installation is exceedingly bad for our carbon content. So, and one other thing he said, photovoltaics, anyone can do it. This is true-ish, but in order to get the subsidies for it, it's a make-work program for solar installation companies. Now, I have been off-grid for over 20 years, and my question is, when am I going to be able to get some new batteries? Because I'm on my third set of lead-acid batteries coming up pretty soon. It's going to be very expensive, and people don't realize that even the smoke in the atmosphere from the fires the other day kept my PV array from fully charging my batteries. And definitely in wintertime, I am dependent on generators and gasoline in order to have electricity during the Rogue Valley winters. So when do I get more efficient batteries is the basic question.
Okay, one of the major ones, I think, for storing solar energy. Thanks for that, Grumpy John. Robert, what do you say?
Well, currently the lithium-ion batteries are the ones that are being developed. Tesla has decided to divert some of their battery production to home battery systems. And lithium batteries have some advantages, one of which is that they have a better lifetime. If they're designed properly, so that you won't be replacing them quite as often. And there's a lot of research going on in batteries right now that I think will produce something in the next few years. I can't say for sure, of course, but there's so many avenues of research being pursued, and the Wall Street has figured out that energy storage is a potentially gigantic source of economic activity. So there are a lot of players that are getting involved. And a lot of different approaches to energy storage. One example would be something like a flow battery, which is the kind of battery that reverses the chemistry in the battery, and instead of storing the energy on the plates, the solid plates in the battery, they store the energy in the liquid. And as they circulate the liquid through, once it gets charged, they can pull it out and put fresh liquid in and continue that process. And then the amount of energy you can store just depends on how big your tank is for the liquid that you want to store. So that kind of different approach to energy storage might in the long run do it. As far as his immediate need for new batteries, I would say look into some of the companies that are starting to do the lithium-ion batteries for home systems.
I was going to ask if the cell phone technology boom has helped out the photovoltaic industry just in ways to store the energy that's coming in from the sun, and it sounds like it is moving that way.
Well, it did. The lithium-ion batteries were developed initially for small portable devices because they're very lightweight. and they can store a high amount of energy relative to the how much mass they carry. So that worked out really well for them. And actually, the original Tesla car, he just took thousands and thousands of those little tiny batteries and strung them together to make a car that could go 200 miles an hour. So,
in a perfect world, or in a world where you got to be the king for a while anyway, when do you think, Robert, we can actually get to the point where we do say, you know, we don't really need the fossil fuels anymore? I mean, a combination of technology, desire, and expenditure, how soon could we get there?
Well, everyone wants it to happen now because they look at the climate change and they worry about it and say, well, we have to do it immediately. We have to get off these fossil fuels. But in actual fact, the transition is going to take decades, and people have to recognize that. So I would say in 50 years, we should be able to look back and say we've retired most of the fossil fuels, but only if we continue to pursue it. If we let the fossil fuel industry continue to block efforts to do solar, then we may not get there. But I think within 50 years, we should have most of it converted over.
How well is photovoltaic coming along? I mean, has that become more efficient over time, too? Is less surface area required, for example, to generate the same amount of energy?
Oh, yeah. The photovoltaics, when I started, were about 10% efficient. Now they're getting up to 20%. So that's doubling it right there. So you wouldn't have to have as much area installed. And there's, again, a lot of research in photovoltaics and looking at the potential for improving efficiency there. So I expect to see them getting up to 25 and 30%.
All right. We'll keep watching. There's a lot to learn in the book, Power Shift from Fossil Energy to Dynamic Solar Power. Robert Arthur Staton wrote it. He's been our guest on The Exchange today. Robert, thanks so much.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Take care.